Go in 3, 2.
This is Christian from Metropolis, America, and you are listening to Comic Pop Library.
To another episode of Comic Pop Visits, brought to you by Comic Pop Library. I'm Richard, along with
Lenny,
and we are on our second part with our discussion with Don Horan. He's the author of the novel Slug Line. He's also working with a Star Trek fan film called Starship Republic. So Don, we appreciate you staying on with us for a little bit longer.
Thank you, guys.
And we're going to throw it to Lenny because he had a question about Slug Line still that had him hankering to ask.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't a question. It was a comment. Okay. I'm not a critic, so I try very hard to avoid going on Amazon for my friends only and putting a little blurb on there and doing the star ratings on their books or whatever, because I have a very hard time, if I like the book at all, putting anything but 5. And I have a very I'm very acceptant. I'm very non-questioning. I don't judge. You know, I just read. And I've read everything from cereal boxes over and over again to really terribly written literature that was never published that I just randomly found in places to
You know, the Penthouse Letters aren't the best place to get literature.
I've read all of those. You know what I'm saying? So I read a lot, and I'm not ignorant of it, but I am not a critic. I did read this once that Stephen King wrote that writers' job in the world is to be a lamppost for the world. You know, you shine your light, and that's what you do. And a critic's job is to piss on that lamppost. So, and I think that that's really true. You know, the thing is that all of the stuff you picked out, you know, that was criticized about your book, that's fair to say. That's fair to say that you know, that is possibly, you know, to me, okay, if you asked me who the protagonist of the book was, I would say the protagonist is the United States of America. Because it was a terrorist plot, and it was a plot against the entire country through these specific individuals for these specific reasons. And then if you ask me who the main bad guy was, well, it's obviously Saeed, because no matter what, he's the trigger. He's, you know, we need him to get all this put together to do it anyway. You know, he had people pulling his strings as well. So you have a network of evil, and you have the agents of good. I think that the whole point that there wasn't this Indiana Jones guy jumping across the thing, doing everything by himself, you know, like, I wrote a book, and I wanted to write about a guy that you could believe in, you know, like literally see, because I didn't want him to be first off, I wanted something to happen to him that was totally fantastical and unbelievable, and then secondly, I wanted you to believe it. So, you know, I took a lot of liberties with literature. And I'm having my biggest problem with actually going to print is that I'm having trouble selling it to anybody that you're actually allowed to write in the way that I've written. but I did it on purpose.
Lenny's a rule breaker.
I'm a rule breaker, and I broke the rules on purpose. And you know, and I'm almost to the point where I'm like, the hell with everybody. I'm just going to print it anyway myself, and you know, let the people, because I don't care what the critics think. The critics don't matter. The only people they matter to are themselves and their friends, and who wants to be friends with a critic? You know, so, and I realize that we're all critics in a way, but as far as like, you know, I criticize the hell out of movies. I criticize the hell out of books too, if I don't like them, you know. But the thing is, if I like it, you've done your job. Your job was to illuminate me, to make me feel something, to excite my interest, to make my brain fire little shots of electricity around in it and make it happy. So since you did that, you know, to me, you know, that there's no point. But you know, you just have to take those kind of criticisms and just, you know, roll with them, because honestly, I think this would make a great movie script. Maybe they gave you a great idea. You need to go sell it to Hollywood, because it at least a made for TV movie, and the believability and the fact that it doesn't wait around to develop a hero is something that they're going to jump at out in Hollywood. You know, and that, but you know, for me, I feel like any good story, it, you know, like you can set and pick apart any story. But ultimately, if it's a good story, it's a good story. And at the end of the day, the readers, the people out there in the world, are going to find that, and they're going to read it, and they're going to enjoy it. But that's really all else I had to say.
I want to say that I wish I was quick enough on my feet to answer William Morris with the answer, the protagonist is the United States of America. I was not that quick on my feet. And, you know, that's a terrific insight, and I really appreciate it. But, you know, what you're saying about being true to where you want to go, you know, I think the thing that carries the book, which again, it leads right into one of the big criticisms, but what carries the book, I think the dialogue has reality to it. It sounds to me the way people would talk in these situations, and I think that's what gives the reader the trust to buy into the narrative, is that the dialogue sounds like people they would talk to every day, or what they would expect somebody to say in these situations. And when you win that trust, I think then, you know, you can take some liberties with the narrative without betraying that trust.
Sure.
So, you know, if you're struggling to, you know, please the masses at the price of betraying what you want to do, you're probably better off doing what you want to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. And, you know, at the end of the day, at least in my case, and I mean, you know, your book may not have pleased certain criticisms, or, you know, they may have not, certain people may not have been interested in it, but I think a lot of people would. And now maybe it's even more relevant to people than it had been several years ago, whenever there was a lot going on with that. But, you know, it's been several years now. So for people that are younger, or for people that, you know, had kind of forgotten, you know, not completely forgotten, but, you know, let it leave their mind. I mean, it's been 15 years since September 11th. So, you know, I can't believe it's been that long, but it has.
I can't either.
You know, and so for me, it was like a snap right back to that time, you know, for that and not my age, not what was going on in my life, but what was going on in the country, and the collective fear and the collective kind of unity. Like, because they were terrorists and because they were on American soil, I cared about the people that they were attacking, because that could have been me, you know. And that's the way, you know, you kind of put it out there. So yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, you know, it's like, it's weird, because it's almost like when you go to the serious publishing industry, they don't want, there is absolutely no risk taken at all. And I'm being very serious at that. Like, they're talking about you know, like a very different style of book. I mean, it is. It's a post 9/11 terrorist thriller. terrorist militaristic thriller, but based more on the terrorist aspect. I mean, the actual United States military gets very little involvement. None of their activities go on the major levels. You know, the personal levels, what's going on with the personnel and, you know, certain players, yes, but not, you know, no major military activities. They didn't, you know, get any SWAT or any kind of Delta Squad involved. So it's like, you know, I don't know. It's weird that people would tell you that you didn't have a good story because they couldn't nail down a protagonist, when I'm like, hey, you should write a whole series about this protagonist. Like, okay, so you guys are basically telling me you didn't read this.
Well, when you try to go the traditional route with a non-traditional entry, you get shot down fast. You get shot down by page 30.
Yeah.
You know, they look at you and they say, well, okay, well, it can't be this guy, can't be that guy. I don't know who I'm rooting for. I'm done.
Yeah.
And, you know, that can happen. You know, it's probably a byproduct of, you know, no formal schooling in the, you know, art of novel writing that would get recognized immediately by an agent or a publisher, say, okay, well, at least this guy went to school, he knows how to diagram a sentence or something, you know. So, you know, that's the limitations of the writer. But my imagination and my vocabulary and my, you know, skill with dialogue, I think, you know, covers up a lot of sins. I certainly don't know the inner workings of the spy machine of the U.S. government, but you know, you can probably figure out a plausible... I mean, I don't think anybody in this book, any character, went outside their job description, or if this was planted on somebody's lap, I don't know if they'd act all that much differently. They might have resources I don't even know about, but, you know, assuming all things being equal, they'd probably pursue it along the lines that I described, I think. But, you know, nobody stood up and said otherwise. So, again, somebody who, you know, lived and worked as a CIA spook would probably read this and say, well, you know, this is...
But they'd never criticize you because they couldn't tell you.
They can't divulge anything.
But, one star, no comment. That's the Amazon review.
One star. But yeah, I mean, you know, it was funny. When you guys had your session with Ray, and Slugline came up, you know, as an ancillary topic, and you guys discussed it a little bit. You know, you both perceived that I had a background in this. And again, I got to tell you, I'm just a layperson. Yeah, I work in the security world, but in the private sector only. Nothing to do with government contracting or anything else. But you'd be amazed what you can pick up from watching television. You know, people laugh at that Peter Sellers movie, but there's something to it.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, you learn from, you know, watching all of these TV shows and these producers that overlap and the directors that overlap, and you start to notice that they have a, you know, what we said about, you know, every single star, every character in the big TV shows, that, you know, everybody got amnesia once. You know, it always happens. But, you know, the writers, they clone one another, and the networks clone each other's shows. There's a lack of originality that, you know, today's entertainment is either a reboot or a sequel or a prequel. Yeah. There's so little new coming out. And, you know, tell you the truth, I don't think the audiences thirst for something new. I think they kind of have a comfort zone, and they like to see it shown three different ways.
You know, and that's what happens is when they get something...
Star Trek has three different timelines going on.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure does.
And that's a good point.
Spider-Man, I think, has about 7 timelines going on. The X-Men got at least 4. Really? Hell, Star Wars almost has 2.
Oh, no, we just have 1.
Almost.
Almost. But I think with that, since we have a reference, we're going to have a shift and jump in and go to warp speed and go boldly where no man has gone before with Don here with Starship Republic. You're actually doing this with Ray Tessie. You've mentioned him a couple of times. We haven't really said
I don't want to steal Ray's thunder. I'm telling you, this is his brainchild. This is his birthright. I contribute on the scripts, but I've never seen anybody work so hard to pull it together with, you know, with high standards. You know, he doesn't want to make a fan film of people playing out like karaoke Star Trek. You know, you're not going to get to be a captain if you look like a librarian. It doesn't happen.
Hey, now.
So, you know, you're going to have some swagger, and you're going to have some ability to not recite lines, but actually digest them, learn them, and emote them.
I have
that's
to.
What he wants to have in this.
Yeah.
And he's not enthralled with the whole special effects carrying 48 minutes of it. He wants to have story.
Right.
And, you know, that's probably what I can contribute most, because the rest of it is beyond me. But I got to tell you, Ray is as reverent and dedicated a Star Trek aficionado without being an asshole.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, he truly knows his stuff. He knows the history of how the show came to be. He knows the flaws. He knows the infighting. He knows all of that. We went to a Star Trek convention at the Statler Hilton in 1972. Neither one of us had a driver's license. We had to literally get permission to go.
Yeah.
You know, and we were in an elevator with Gene Roddenberry and Major Barrett and didn't know it.
Oh, no.
If you went to a Bonanza convention, would you know David Dortort? Probably not.
Yeah.
You know, there was no internet. There was no nothing.
Yeah.
And, you know, when we went to the Gene and Major forum that they had, you know, Ray said, holy shit, we're in the elevator. You know, we have 16 scripts under our arms trying to peddle them to anybody. We're sitting watching the blooper reel in the back of a balcony with DC Fontana. And, you know, she tells us that you should, you know, talk to this one, talk to that. Well, we wind up on some... that 1972 convention was God, I wish I could remember the guy who ran it. God, Ray would know. But yeah, he's way over his head. But I do know the funny thing about that convention was that WPIX was showing some event. I think it might have been a golf match or something that ran over the 6 o'clock time thing when there was nothing going on. Everybody's in their room. Everybody's going to turn on Star Trek, and it was preempted for something. And we called WPIX in New York and said, there's 3,000 of us over here looking for Star Trek, and you're not showing it. And what's going on with that? And, you know, we're going to come over to that studio. And next thing you know, back then they just put up a blank screen and they said, we are sorry to have preempted our normal programming. We will show our programming in its entirety at the conclusion. That never would have happened today. Yeah. Never. First of all, nobody would answer the phone today.
Yeah, that is true.
They just let you go to voicemail.
You know, there's so many wonderful things about the early Star Trek conventions in New York. They are simply magical. Because they were so spontaneous, so unexpected, so unrehearsed, so unscripted that, you know, it was just one of those things. And over the next 3 or 4 years, it became a commercial enterprise, pardon the pun, and then it became what it became. But until that time, it was pretty freelance, and I'm telling you, you could get in an elevator with Gene Roddenberry and not know you were with him,
huh.
Or just, you know, be a dick like we were and not know we were with them.
Well, with the Starship Republic, when did you and Ray actually start talking about this and actually start making inroads to actually make it a reality like you're starting to now?
Well, I had no idea that fan films were going on. I didn't know about it, but Ray organized and ran a convention in 2009 I think it was 2000. I called Naruto Trek. I didn't know what Naruto was, but Ray's marketing idea was that a Star Trek convention on its own in Southern Florida was not going to attract a crowd. If you could combine it with some other medium, such as animation, and Naruto was such a big deal, he thought he'd get a cross culture of interest and a cross attraction that people would come in. And I'm telling you, this guy put this together all by himself. He got Walter Koenig to come. He got Christina Moses to come. He got nobody knows who she is, but she's pretty hot. she was like Sulu's daughter in a fan film, but everybody really thought she was the bee's knees at the place. She got he got Vic Montagna, but the Elvis impersonator guy.
Couldn't help you there. I don't know him.
Do you know who we mean?
Nope.
Guy who plays familiar. He plays Captain Kirk in his own. He was like one of the first fan film guys, and his real full-time job is an Elvis impersonator.
I didn't know that.
yeah. I'm not making this up. Ray would know his name. Again, Ray would know his name. But James something. James Cawley.
Okay.
So he came, and they had the first screening of a James Cawley episode was at this Ray-run convention. Cool. I was just amazed at what he was able to pull off as one guy and still, you know, have a full-time job and, you know, two kids and a wife and blah, 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 and the car, you know, everybody's got that. Yet he was able to do this all by himself. He didn't do it all right, but he did it.
Right.
And, you know, when he started talking to me about these fan films, he said, I need to watch this. So I watched a bunch of them. And he said, you know, I would like to do something in the TOS timeline with a sister ship. And he researched the early World of Star Trek book and came up with the early starships. Then he found one that never made it to the screen called the Republic. And he thought, you know, we should hang our hat on this. Let's get the Starship Republic a crew. And, you know, before Starship Republic, and this is, I'm talking 30 years ago, we wrote a treatment and 13 subsequent episodes for a TV show that we wanted to sell called The Seahawks, which was like Star Trek in the 1500s. It's probably influenced by the Next Generation episode where they're all on the pirate ship.
Okay.
But, you know, we kind of paralleled the characters. We had, you know, we had the captain, an alien first officer, meaning he was not British. I think he was Portuguese and skilled in certain languages and had other traits. And, you know, an ornery doctor and all the usual stuff. But this was an outcast ship. I think they may have deposed their captain. They were on the run. But, you know, they had this idea that they would one day, you know, restore their citizenship or whatever. But the reality, the point is that we wrote this thing like Star Trek, and they had all these adventures and all this other stuff. It was just such a natural thing. And then Ray said, you know, we ought to take the crew from, shit, I don't even remember the name of that ship that we wrote. He said, let's take that crew and put it on the Republic and see what we can do with it. And we, you know, the pilot episode was a breeze to write because it involved a science vessel that, you know, got in over their head and they called for a starship. But when the starship got there, the science vessel was like, you know, we're like I said, we're over our head. And
do you want me to cut that last part out? Because I don't know how much Ray wants to divulge about the plot or anything.
Which part is that?
The first part that you were just describing of the first episode.
Oh, should I not?
We don't know. You're the one.
Well, I don't know if Ray really wants that out there or not. So
he'll get over it.
Okay.
He'll get over it.
Okay. I just want to make sure so I don't get us or you in trouble.
Don's like, whatever. I'm not getting in trouble.
I'll edit if people want me to, but this will probably stay in there too, so Ray knows I asked you.
That's the real reason he asks. I was going to say this earlier, Richard. You don't look like a librarian, so that comment was not at all. He probably met you, has gone this far in his life, and still didn't know that he's the actual librarian here at Kearney County Library. We're actually in the library right now.
Hey, look, I got all the respect in the world for anybody who's launching these fan films. I saw them, I watched them. You know, some of them made you cringe. I'm sorry. You know?
Yeah. Well, I do understand what you mean.
You can't knock the effort. You can't say, hey, you know, this somebody had this dream to put this up there and to wear the captain's uniform and sit on the bridge, and by God, they made it happen. Maybe they made it happen in the waiting room of a starbase, but, you know, they made it happen.
Right.
So, you know, the hats off to them. You don't see anybody doing Mod Squad fan films, do you? No. So, you know, good for them.
I have to make a comment, though. When you were talking about the Seahawks that you wrote about, talking about how you kind of paralleled it with Star Trek, in the back of my head, I was just like, okay, he's telling the person at the, I don't know what they call it, but the wheel, said,
helm.
Okay, the helm. Okay, we need to go to wind power instead of warp power. Maximum wind power now.
Wind four.
Give us the second sail.
That's what I would do. I would if I was doing that, what I would do is like have them labeled like whereas when the main sail's out, the last sail, that's you know, sail nine. So get us to sail nine, you know.
You can't
like
risk it.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, out of nowhere, here comes the Pirates of Caribbean for like, you know, four movie franchise.
Right.
I can't tell you how many concepts Ray and I wrote as I won't say as kids, you know, in high school and college, that actually made it. You know, yeah. I mean, that made it. They weren't under the same banner or anything, but. You know, we weren't far off on concepts. You know, we wrote, well, back in the day, there were these hour and a half TV movies on ABC called Movies of the Week, you know, and they were TV tripe. But, you know, Spielberg started on that with Duel and everything else. And, you know, some of them had top flight actors who were, you know, maybe over the hill, who knows. But, you know, we would write constantly. I mean, we'd go to the movies in the Bronx, right? We'd go to the movies, we watch Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3. So we watched that movie and say, that's a phenomenal movie. Phenomenal. You know, they got the city by the short hairs. They're coughing up the moon. So we wrote a movie about the tramway between Queens and Roosevelt Island. And, you know, we said, okay, we're going to do the same thing. We're going to hijack the tramway. Now, of course, as a TV movie, you're hanging over the East River. There's not too many places to go. And, you know, we said, okay, you got to send the other tram out and send the money over, then we'll let the hostages go. But we had this, you know, we had this escape plan where the robbers who brought on these big military-sized duffel bags were going to escape using jetpacks. Now, that sounds like Lost in Space, Guy Robinson, all that other stuff. But as it happened, we came upon that solution of how to get them off the tramway because there was a jetpack exhibition in New Jersey on TV, and we're like, hey, that's a real thing. That's how they get off. So, you know, we wrote that whole script. Believe it or not, it got some interest. It really got some interest, but they didn't like the ending. So we looked at the guy. His name was Adam Berg from William Morris. And we looked at him and said, well, how do you think they'd get off this bucket over the river? You got a better idea? And it was like, well, you know, why don't they just wear fake police uniforms and, you know, blend in with the crowd? So, okay. So, you know, sometimes you just dig your heels in and you don't compromise. But, you know, Ray and I have had an awful lot of close calls. You know, we wrote a full script, full 26-minute script for a Barney Miller episode that was genuinely funny. I mean, genuinely funny. We sent it to Danny Arnold, and you know, we got it back unopened with a cover letter that we don't take unsolicited material or something like that. I don't even know if we got it back. But so we picked up the phone and we called. Believe it or not, you could do this back then. We actually called the studio and asked for Danny Arnold's office, got his secretary, and I said, you know, I'm a private detective in New York. and I'd like to speak with Mr. Arnold about a confidential matter. Right. Here's my number. Son of a gun, if the guy didn't call back.
What pictures do you have?
She called back and said, I have Mr. Arnold for you.
Sure.
And, you know, we said, well, you know, we're a bunch of shitheads who, you know, are just trying to get your attention to a script we wrote. And then we got the script back with handwritten by Danny Arnold saying, this is really good. You guys should join the Screen Actors Guild or the Writers Guild or something. But, you know, this is really good. And good luck to you. So yeah. Here we are now at this age, you know, still trying to cash in on that clover that, you know, we did 40 years ago. But, hey, it's not the end of the world for us. We enjoy it. Ray is able to be connected through, I don't know how, to a lot of wonderful people that, you know, still share the dream and put it on. I think what those guys do out in Oklahoma City is out of this world. Yes. They actually spend their time building sets and letting people use them. They're very generous. And
a shout out to Starbase Studios.
Their Promenade Con, is that what it's called?
Promenade Con, yes. That's
yeah, I mean, I wish that would get some traction because if nothing else, they're certainly not in it for the money. Right. So they're true believers and true artisans, and I think it's a great thing that these people are involved in.
And I know, just to kind of give a shout out, that's Starbase Studios down in Oklahoma City. And for Vance Majors, the Promenadicon, he is going to be having a second one. That's going to be October 22nd at Starbase Studios.
And we hope that it gets a lot of traction, too. You know, that was the first event. How long has the studio been there, Richard? Do you even know?
I want to say 3-4 years.
So it's still fairly new
because it was in El Reno for a little while.
Yeah, and it is growing the attraction, and it's getting almost out of hand. we actually have made contacts just through this with one director who's an independent film director. I mean, he works for a studio based out of Germany, but he's independent basically in the fact that he works for himself. You know, he does the directing, then he sends it to the studio or whatever. But we met him, and then he basically through an interview invited us to come along to Starbase Studios in Oklahoma City, and we're like, we were just there. Did you hear about us from them? And he's like, you know about them, you know. So like, this is a guy that's on the internet and looking basically a Star Trek fan, you know, who wanted to make it. And so we've actually gotten to end up going down there and working with him, and
hopefully
very, very professional. I can't wait to see that episode or that what he's got planned. He's very good. But yeah, so you know, we hope, and I can see it getting a lot of traction because there is such interest in the TOS, the original series, and I really think that you know, for the few years that it's been going, to me it seems like that they've got more and more projects going on there, more people coming. There's another director out of Southern California that we're supposed to meet out there at the next Promenadicon and make plans for interviews and stuff like that for projects that he wants to do there. And you know, I think that the more people, you know, kind of give back to them and try to, you know, do their projects there, and
you're spot on with that. I think people have really got to recognize, and first they got to learn of it, but when they learn of it, they got to recognize what these guys have done and the forum they have provided people that had nowhere else to go, no outlet. And, you know, just the networking, to borrow a phrase, of finding, you know, like-minded people, and Ray ran into people with skill sets that, you know, I don't know where he would have recruited them from if he didn't meet them there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think it's a terrific thing. I don't think the guys who put that on get the credit they deserve, because it's all on their backs. I mean, they do all the labor, they do it all, and they do it as a labor of love. It's like I said, it's not a commercial enterprise. It's art, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, and I think that some great films are going to be made there and have been made there, and I feel like it's going to only grow until it's a monster and it's out of control and it's terrorizing Oklahoma City.
I wish it for them.
I do too, and I hope to be there when it happens. Maybe not, you know, in the limelight, but definitely standing aside and applauding, because I certainly appreciate those guys. And I feel you, like, you're exactly right. They don't get the credit they deserve. They deserve so much credit just for the idea, just for doing it, and then the hours of the effort that they put in, because just being there for, what was it, 1.5 days, working on one film project, you know, we saw what exactly goes into trying to get a movie produced basically without money. And
and they're all family men, and they all, you know, and they get help from their friends, and people show up, the people they know. I just was very impressed with the whole thing, because again, it certainly was not a commercial enterprise, and I think the guys behind that deserve every bit of support that people can muster. I think they did. I think the people who showed up and got tables and exhibited and everything were, you know, true supporters, and they also need to shout out.
And just to mention their names, the two co-owners of Starbucks Studios are Richard Wells and Scott Johnson. So we greatly appreciate
it. Those are the gentlemen we got to be shouting out to. And they are really great guys. We got a chance to get to know them pretty well. And really awesome guys doing a great thing for the entire Star Trek world. Because like I said, we're meeting people from California, Florida, you know, all over the country that are going there because Starbase Studios is, South Carolina, isn't
South
it? Starbase Studios is literally the only open to the public bridge set that exists in the United States. I mean, there might be another one in Croatia or something that I don't know about, but it's probably the only one in the world. No, they probably have one in Britain, because once they found out we had one, they had to build one out in Hampshire or somewhere.
That follows.
Yeah. But other than that, you know, there's no one else doing this for Star Trek, and really it's great, because Star Trek it's a hard thing to film without a bridge set. You know, that's like the first thing you think of is like, well, you could do all the, you know, away stuff, and you could do digital stuff with the space and the ships and with the aliens, but how are you going to have the captain's chair and the whole bridge set? And when you walk on there and you see it, like, what I, even as somebody that really wasn't a follower of the original series at all, I haven't even really seen most of the episodes of the original. You know, I'm sorry, I'm a sinner, but I'm a Next Generation guy. I grew up with the Next Generation. You know, that was really my favorite television show growing up. So I could totally dig the concept.
The greatest thing that show accomplished is that it overcame the resistance of expectations that the TOS generation had, and there was such a media pushback, and some of it deserved. You know, they had a lot of what Ray used to call thud episodes. You know, a great 46 minutes, and then the last 4 minutes was a thud.
it was a
we'll get back to you later kind of thing. But they really had a breakthrough with Enterprise C. They had a real breakthrough moment, I think, because the acting was fabulous in that. And I'm not saying I'm not dismissing the episodes that came before it. There was certainly some gems there, but that Enterprise C episode really put TNG on the map, as far as I'm concerned, because it was so when Picard whispers that the war is not going well. Can you imagine on TOS the Federation losing to the Klingons? I mean, that was such a smack in the face. The war's not going well. You got to go back, because if you don't, you know, maybe there's a shot, but if you don't, we're going to lose. Oh my God.
True.
So I like that. And then they really took off in their middle and late years. They did some great television. They did some great sci-fi. I really like TNG, and they really won over. Well, you know, if you're going to be stubborn and wish for Star Trek episodes where the captain could grab the yeoman's waist and stuff, great, knock yourself out. But, you know, notice I said waist.
Yes.
knock yourself out. But, you know, I thought TNG was for a syndicated show with the budget they had and the, you know what's really weird about the spinoff shows though? I have nobody to talk to about this, so I'll talk to you guys about it.
Go for it.
So many of those actors who were on that show, on all those subsequent shows, went nowhere.
Yeah.
I mean,
or like Patrick Stewart went everywhere. Yeah, right.
Tom Paris was like, you know, supposed to be the Beach Boy or something. I what happened to him? What happened to, you know, so many of the characters that were on there, they never got launched.
Yeah.
Except within the Star Trek world and the Star Trek convention world and everything else. But, you know, Michael Dorn might do some Allstate commercials from time to time. And, right. You know, what are these guys doing?
And Jonathan Frakes doesn't.
Why are they so glossed over? Why hasn't Harry Kim and why hasn't B'Elanna Torres and why hasn't Chakotay and why hasn't the crew? I mean, what happened to that Enterprise Vulcan? You know, she did movies before Enterprise, hasn't done a thing since.
It's almost like a curse. But then on the other side of the coin, you know, you can't turn a channel without seeing Patrick Stewart's dome. Even as a cartoon, they still made the guy look like him.
Yeah,
they basically had been predicting that he was going to be Professor X since the early. I read in Wizard magazine in 1992. 93 maybe, because that's when I was really into Wizard magazine, when I was really into comics, 12, 13 years old, that Patrick Stewart would be Professor X, Jean-Luc Picard, Patrick Stewart, you know, and that Logan or Wolverine would be played by Glenn Danzig. They got the Wolverine wrong, but they nailed Patrick Stewart right in the head. And, you know, it's like he's been in everything. All over the place. Commercials, television, movies. He's got cartoons going.
The leads came into it as leads, and they exited it. I mean, Shatner had to claw his way back through Promise commercials and Priceline. But
yeah, but he's back.
Denny Crane is as much in the culture as James Kirk is.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, Kate Mulgrew is an established actress. And Deep Space Nine. True. You know, that actor who's Avery Brooks, he had plenty of credentials before and after. But the lower cast, I mean, Major Neera, nothing. Trip, nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, although we did see, let's take a salute to Game of Thrones, that Dr. Bashir made it on, you know.
Yeah, onto the Game of Thrones, cast.
Yeah, just to get, you know. Killed by women.
Yeah.
That'll happen.
That's the great and terrible thing about being cast on they're like, congratulations, you're on Game of Thrones this week.
But now.
Depending on when if you get stabbed, you know, you may be on it next week too. It's like, I was on the Game of Thrones. Oh, that's great. You know, how much did you make? Oh, well, I only got paid for a week, then they killed me. So, you know.
You know, secretly, I want a Bashir to play Saeed.
Yeah.
That'd be a good casting.
Yeah.
That would work.
In the movie. But, you know, I just don't understand why these syndicated actors cannot break out. You know, there was, I mean, Chakotay, nobody's heard of that guy. Do they just go into witness protection or what?
Now, I had seen Brent Spiner in a few things since.
I've seen Brent Spiner. I haven't seen Troy in much.
No.
Well, they go into that convention trap and they can't get out.
But in a lot of ways, it's not, you know, a lot of ways that's like for, especially like for Star Trek and these longer running series that had good followings, at least for the actor, if they can't find other work, that is a type of work. You know, a lot of those guys are getting paid decent money to go attend those conventions. So, at least they're still working. I mean, you got to play Deanna Troi the rest of your life, but hey, at least you know, and the thing is the people that go to those conventions, the regular Joes like me, man, if I went and I saw Jonathan Frakes at a convention, I'd freak out, you know? And I mean, just because he was my favorite guy on Star Trek, you know? And it doesn't even, it's just because of who he is, you know? He is William Riker to me, so, you know, he's always going to be William Riker to me. And maybe that's the problem, is they were so iconic in that show, because it is such an iconic show. And, you know, those series, they did have to shoot so hard because of TOS's You know, you know, it's still, you know, you still can't mess with them. They're like, they're sitting on a golden throne. I say anything about the next generation, they're like, TOS, slap you down. You know nothing, Lynn Snow. You know nothing because you don't watch TOS, so you just shut up with your next generation garbage. But
I have to say, I think TNG aged very well. I see it today on that BBC channel, sometimes on cable, and I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, this has aged pretty well. When you see TOS episodes, if you're not up for camp, you're not going to like it. But, you know, they also had their golden moments on TOS that really survive.
Yeah.
I think the acting in City on the Edge is, you know, it endures over decades. That was realistic. Everybody was in it and on it. You know, I remember when I was a kid when Naked Time first came on, the second episode, and it was like, I was looking at my watch, it was 5 to 10, and suddenly the chronometer started running backwards. I was like, holy crap, holy crap, what's going on? And then like, okay, they're running forward again. Okay, you know, but you know, for that split second, it was like electric television, and they did such good things on that show. They had, well, you know, if they didn't, we wouldn't be sitting here today, right?
Yeah,
true.
Exactly.
If that one show didn't do it, none of this would have been foreseen or done. And, you know, whatever the infighting and backstories were in the studio and everything else, who cares? At the end of the day, we got, you know, the Enterprise, and we got the Enterprise D, and we got, you know, I thought Voyager had some fantastic episodes. So, you know, it's we have a lot to be grateful for, that there's this entertainment product that brought so many diverse people together, both fans and artists and, you know, a couple of whack jobs here and there. But, you know, mostly people who really get it and like it and are not, you know, critical of each other. Again, I hearken back to those early Star Trek conventions in New York, how unscripted they were. And, you know, when they ran out of tickets, everybody got in for free. And when the fire marshal came and said, yeah, you know, you can only... It was way, way off the charts what the response was to that. And you can see what that gave birth to today.
Yeah,
true.
You know, is mega cons. So... you know, kudos to those pioneers on both sides of the spectrum, the ones in front of the cameras and the ones in front of the TVs.
Right.
You know, everybody contributed in some way to being where we are now, which is, you know, people with great appreciation for what was done.
Before we head out, just a couple more things I want to get your thoughts about. The first one is, we're talking about the TV series. What do you think about the new upcoming series that CBS is planning?
Richard, I think you asked me a question, but I'm going to have to defer to my translator.
Okay. Well, what do you think about the new Star Trek series that's coming out from CBS?
I think they are going to have a drastic misstep because I think what they are trying to do is cash in before they deliver.
Yeah,
okay.
And I think that is a drastic misstep, but, you know, you got four-year-olds with crayons in the boardroom, and this is what you get. you know, it's all promise. It's nothing up front. They're not willing to invest in the audience. They're not willing to put the fan first. It's like, we're going to tease you. We're going to hook you. We're going to drag you in. We're going to make all the money that we can. And we're not going to show you anything. And, you know, we're starved for new material. And because we're faithful, we're going to follow along to some degree. But at the end of the day, they'll do their brand great damage if they don't deliver.
Yeah.
And they ought to wake up and realize that. But, you know, you're looking at people who think long-term planning is the first quarter.
Yeah.
True. That is true.
yeah, I hope that's not what happens. It would be great if they have some sort of secret weapon. But most likely, it's just a bunch of... puffed up jargon. And I mean, you know, and the way that that's the way you're right. I mean, even being a little bit younger and not so I, you know, I'm not so jaded as to the way that the industry of entertainment is. But it is very much obvious to where I can see the way it's set in its ways. And one of the ways that I think that the American movie industry is killing itself, especially with the advent of technologies that are making it more and more possible for people to just do it themselves. And because that's where the talent's going to go, where the possibility exists. And that's the problem. They're losing the talent, and with that talent, they're also losing innovation. They don't have the innovation anymore, so they don't have any good new ideas. And because they aren't those innovative people that are coming up with those great new ideas, they're scared of them. They don't want new ideas. They don't want anything original. They want something that's already packaged. They already have a logo. They want to smack it on there. They want to pump it up real big, and then tell you that you really enjoyed it. and the thing is
the likes and the clicks to prove it.
Yeah, and you know, and the thing is that you know, at the end of the day, Hollywood will probably always be Hollywood in my lifetime, but they really could see a lot of you know, a lot of the best films that are coming out each year aren't even getting mentioned because they're not coming out of Southern California. They're coming out of different places. They're coming out of, you know, ingenuity that is because, you know, you talk about this new tech, the new technology in the world, you know, it's becoming more and more possible. Pretty soon we'll be able to print a bridge on our 3D printers that looks exactly, yeah, not close, but exactly, yeah, like the one that, yeah, Kirk set in. And then we'll be able to digitally remaster everything from our own personal computers with a 3D pen and VR glasses. So it's sitting right here in front of us. And, you know, and like literally everything is at the verge of just being at the hands of whoever does it best. Well, so it's no longer, you know, like it's what I was going to say about getting into the publishing industry when, yeah, we were talking about Slugline still. Like it no longer matters if you can impress the guys on Madison Avenue or even down on Hollywood Boulevard. You know, what matters now is can you convince people to check you out on Facebook, follow you on Twitter? It really does. It matters how well you can market yourself because no one's marketing anyone else's crap anymore. That's over. Everyone's just going to be having to do it themselves. Everything's going to be a do-it-yourself.
I think that is a real wake-up call, and you know, not news to anybody. It's just that there seems to be, you know, a resistance and a pushback, and people have dug in their heels, and they're not going to accept it. And you know, God knows, I've seen those business plans go right down the tubes in the face of what you're describing. You know, you're absolutely right. You can be an internet sensation, and that was never available before. You had to crawl to three networks. But you know, with live streaming and with these independent channels and cable TV and Hulu and everything else, there's a lot of opportunity out there. I just wish, you know, you could figure out how to crack the code, just like when there were just three networks and you had to figure out how to crack the code. You know, I wish there was a Hulu for dummies, because you know, there's plenty of material and talent that's just languishing. You know, looking to get discovered, and you know, unless you catch a spark or catch a wave, and you can go viral and you know, get the attention. But you know, it does happen. It happens with great frequency, and you know, it should give everybody reason to continue to pursue it.
Right.
True. Well, we're running up on time again, Don. Want to get one quick question in again before we sound off for the night. Going back to Starship Republic, just what stage are you guys at? Has casting been done? Is filming getting ready to be kind of talked about? And kind of go into that before we ring off for the night.
Well, I think casting's been done, because I'm copying on the emails that Ray has been sending out to the, I think there's 8 main characters that he's got, you know, consistently engaged. It's at a point where they want to film what did he call it?
Trailer or promo?
A promo for sure, where he wants to have the captain actor, okay, not in uniform, in, you know, introduce himself as the actor and describe the project, and then cut to some live scenes, okay, whether they're stills or whether they're live action, I'm not sure, and then come back to that actor. To talk about, I don't know if it's crowdfunding is the term.
There's one, but like that.
I know that Ray has the seed money to okay, move forward on the October opportunity of being there and using the studios and getting everybody there. So, you know, the thing is that, Ray's had to juggle a couple of real fastballs in his personal life. His dad passed away, a great American hero, World War II veteran, a great guy. And, you know, that's been a bit of a setback for him. And, you know, a couple of other things that have gone on. But, you know, one thing about Ray, he's resilient. He believes in it. He's committed to it. He puts his own money and his own effort behind it. He seems to have a great rapport with the crew that he has recruited. They all seem to be very much on board with what he wants to do. I just think his incremental approach is the right way to go. It is a crowded field. It's a crowded field, and if you don't stand out based on something other than flesh, you're just one of the many. But I think he has the right approach. There's got to be a nostalgia factor in there for the craftsmanship of a 1960s era TV episode, and I think he's really found his way into that. And okay, the story, forgive me for saying so because I've been involved in it, I think it's a great story because he's able to, we all have the benefit of knowing what went on after TOS, so you're able to reach into the future and pull some seeds from the future back into the TOS timeline without taking liberties.
Sure.
That make people go, oh wow, and that's really good. Somebody once wrote a book, and I read it and I loved it, and I don't know who it was or what the book was, but they explained that the Doomsday Machine was indeed a prototype that was built by a desperate race to ward off the Borg.
Right, I've heard that.
I read that. I said, hey, that's a great book. Bravo, great, a big hand.
Yeah.
Because they combined both universes. Mm-hmm. Nobody really understood what the Doomsday Machine was doing out there. And, here's an explanation, because the Borg, as it was, transcended, quite the timeline and centuries from quadrant to quadrant. And I read that book, and I thought that was one of the best Star Trek books ever. So, Ray's vision for Republic is to draw on the future as much as, the past.
Okay.
That's cool. Fun stuff.
Cool. All right, well, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been visiting with Don Horan, and you can catch up with his projects at starshiprepublic.com, where he's one of the writers for the series. Also, his novel Slugline, you can get more information at slug-line.net, where you can go to Amazon and pick up the book there. Don, we've been having fun. I hope you've been having fun visiting with us tonight.
This is a great night, guys. You're very generous with your time. I really appreciate the forum.
It's not a problem at all.
And we appreciate all the kind words you've given to us this evening as well. So thank you very much for doing that.
And thank you.
All right. We're going to sign off. We hope everybody's having fun out there listening. We've definitely had fun visiting with Don. We're going to have him on again sometime and do some more just BSing, I think. Until next time, thank you, everybody, for listening. We'll see you later. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to Comic Pop Library. We welcome your comments and suggestions by emailing us at admin@comicpoplibrary.com. All emails submitted become the property of Comic Pop Library and are subject for use in our show. We would also appreciate it if you would spread the word about Comic Pop Library by posting about us on Twitter, Facebook, or just tell someone about us. This podcast is not endorsed by any publisher, distributor, or studio, and it is intended for entertainment and information purposes only. The views and comments of the show hosts are their own and are not reflective in any business, entity, or organization associated with ComicPopLibrary.com.